In 2026, the people who actually keep commercial airplanes from falling out of the sky, they came to a rather startling realization.
Yeah, it really changed the whole conversation.
Right, because you'd think the biggest existential threat to global aviation safety would be, I don't know, a faulty engine turbine or something.
Or like a degraded hydraulic line.
Exactly. Or even, a shortage of high-grade aerospace titanium. But it wasn't any of those things. The biggest threat to human flight was paperwork.
Just the sheer compounding, suffocating weight of global administrative drag.
So today, we are going on a deep dive into how a multi-billion dollar hypercritical industry basically went to war over data burdens, supply chains, and the fundamental right to just turn a wrench.
It's a fascinating pivot, honestly, in how we understand aerospace maintenance. And we're pulling this from a very specific stack of sources today.
Yeah, primarily an article from Aviation Maintenance magazine.
Right, dated March 31st, 2026. The piece is titled, It's All There. And it gives us this incredible postmortem of the 2026 annual conference of ARRSAE.
Which is the Aeronautical Repair Station Association.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this because, if you just read that title, Aeronautical Repair Station Association Annual Conference, you might immediately assume we are about to slog through an hour of dry, inside baseball bureaucratic committee minutes.
Oh, totally. It sounds incredibly dry.
Right. But the mission of this deep dive is to show you the hidden machinery of this world. Like, this conference is not just some polite networking event, it is a battlefield.
It really is. The stakes that get discussed in these rooms, they dictate the reality of global mobility.
Because the aviation maintenance sector is the absolute foundation of human flight.
Right. If this system fractures, the entire global supply chain just halts.
Wow.
So when this association meets, they aren't just chatting. They are negotiating the protection of billions of dollars in capital investments and, the daily safety of millions of passengers.
Not to mention the fragile logistics that keep the global economy actually moving.
Exactly. It's high-stakes diplomacy, but it's disguised as a trade show.
And the article gives us this really detailed breakdown of how this massive global industry actually governs itself. But rather than just walking through their schedule day by day, I think we need to look at the underlying structural themes.
Yeah, the themes are where the real story is.
And the first major one hits you before the physical conference even begins. The article highlights this pre-conference newsletter from the association president, John Riggs.
Right, the February newsletter.
Yeah. And in this message to the members, Riggs refers to his own upcoming keynote, like his State of the Association address, as, and this is a quote, perfunctory.
Which is just an incredibly revealing word choice.
I mean, a trade association president calling his own keynote address perfunctory? Like, meaning carried out with a minimum of effort or reflection, that is almost unheard of.
It really is. Usually, that speech is the tentpole of the entire year for these organizations.
Right.
It's the moment the grand vision is handed down from the mountaintop to all the members.
Yeah, my initial read on that was honestly just confusion. Like, is he just checked out?
Right, like he's phoning it in.
Exactly. Is this a leader who is literally telling his membership, hey, don't expect much from me this year? Because that seems like terrible optics, telling thousands of attendees that your big speech is basically a rehash.
It looks like terrible optics until you actually understand the operational mechanics he's pointing to. He isn't phoning it in at all.
Okay.
He's actually outlining a radical shift in how effective advocacy works. Riggs explains in that newsletter that anyone applying critical thinking will realize his address is merely a recitation of the ongoing work the IRSA team has been communicating all year long.
So he's highlighting a model of like continuous, transparent, real-time advocacy.
Precisely. He's making the argument that a massive top-down yearly speech is just an outdated artifact.
It's like, okay, it's like a university professor handing you a highly detailed syllabus on the absolute last day of the semester.
That's a great way to put it.
Right, because if you've been doing the heavy reading, if you've been attending the lectures and participating in the labs all year long, that final summary document doesn't give you any new information. You already know it.
You've lived it.
Yeah. So Riggs is basically flexing. He's saying the association's day-to-day communication apparatus is so aggressive and so thorough that they just don't need to save their big updates for a ballroom in March.
Which forces us to look at who is actually building and running that day-to-day apparatus. Because if the president is acting as this figurehead delivering a perfunctory summary, who is in the trenches?
Exactly. So who is actually running this daily communication machine?
Well, the text introduces a really pivotal figure operating behind the scenes. Brett Levanto.
Okay.
And his role is the key to understanding this entire organizational structure. Levanto is the vice president of operations of Obadal, Filler, McLeod, and Klein, PLC.
Wait, let me push back on that setup for a second, because, I mean, that's a law firm.
It is.
Obadal, Filler, McLeod, and Klein. If you have an aerospace maintenance association representing mechanics, repair stations, and parts manufacturers, why in the world is their vice president of operations sitting inside a law firm?
It's a great question.
Because wouldn't you normally hire a massive public relations agency or, you know, a dedicated internal communications director? Why outsource your central nervous system to a group of lawyers?
Well, because in the highly regulated world of aviation, communication is not public relations.
Okay.
Communication is legal strategy. Levanto's specific mandate, as it's outlined in the text, is managing firm and client communications in conjunction with regulatory and legislative policy initiatives.
Wow.
Right. Furthermore, he provides the strategic and logistical support for IRSA itself.
So translate that into how it actually works on like a random Tuesday in October.
Sure.
If the FAA drops a massive notice of proposed rulemaking about, say, composite material fatigue limits, the association doesn't need a PR spin on it.
No, not at all.
They need a legal interpretation of how that rule impacts their liability, and they need it distributed to 300,000 mechanics immediately.
You've hit the nail on the head. When a regulatory agency shifts a standard, the repair stations need to know the immediate compliance steps.
Right.
So Levanto's operational setup means that the strategic communication going out to the membership isn't just a newsletter. It is highly actionable, legally vetted intelligence.
That makes so much sense.
Obadal, Filler, McLeod, and Klein isn't just acting as outside counsel. They provide the actual operational backbone. They integrate legislative policy initiatives directly into the daily communications.
So by the time these executives actually travel to this conference in March, they are already fully briefed.
Exactly. They have been digesting the legal and strategic output from Levanto's team all year.
And that continuous baseline of knowledge completely liberates the physical gathering.
It really does. Because if you don't have to spend the first 2 days of a conference catching everyone up on the basics of a new FAA mandate, you can lock the doors and dedicate that physical proximity to high-level tactical problem solving.
Which brings us perfectly into the macroeconomic reality these executives are actually dealing with when they get in those rooms.
Day one?
Yeah, day one, March 17th. The article discusses these executive-to-executive briefings, or E2E sessions. These are hand-picked participants, closed-door meetings.
Very exclusive.
Right. And the agenda specifically pivots completely away from the Federal Aviation Administration.
Which is surprising.
It is. Instead, they bring in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative. They are getting economic briefings from Oliver Wyman Vector. They are deep in the weeds on tariffs, supply chain issues, and refund options.
Yeah, they really get into the economics.
But I'm struggling to see the connection here. Like, wait, why is an aviation maintenance conference talking to the U.S. Trade Representative about tariffs instead of talking to the FAA about airplane parts?
Well, that assumes aviation maintenance is purely a technical endeavor.
Right, like just wrenches and grease.
Exactly. But at the executive level, aviation maintenance is a multi-billion-dollar global logistics puzzle. An aircraft is not built, nor is it repaired, with components sourced from a single domestic zip code.
No, of course not.
Commercial aviation is entirely reliant on international trade. You might have specialized avionics manufactured in Europe, raw titanium forged in Asia, and advanced composite materials from South America.
And all of that needs to converge on a single hangar in Ohio at the exact right moment.
Exactly. So the mechanics of turning the wrench are, well, they're secondary to the mechanics of actually acquiring the wrench and the parts.
Or at least inextricably linked.
Right. If the U.S. Trade Representative implements a new Section 232 tariff on specific alloys or electronic components, it sends a massive shockwave through the maintenance supply chain.
Because a tariff doesn't just make a repair slightly more expensive.
Yeah. No, it disrupts the delicate calculus of the entire industry. Profit margins for maintenance repair organizations, or MROs, can be incredibly tight because the baseline cost of acquiring certified aerospace materials is already astronomical.
And the article explicitly mentions discussions around, quote, tariff impacts and refund options.
Yes.
That refund aspect seems crucial. Walk me through what that actually looks like. How does a repair station get a refund on a tariff?
It is a notoriously complex process. It's known as duty drawback, or navigating specific tariff exclusion processes.
Okay.
Let's say your Ohio repair station imports a specialized European landing gear strut that currently falls under a heavy retaliatory tariff.
Ouch.
Right. So the repair station pays that massive tax just to get the part into the hangar. They service it, install it onto a commercial jet, and that jet subsequently flies out of the country, re-exporting the part.
Oh, I see.
Under certain trade frameworks, the repair station can claim a refund on the initial tariff because the good didn't stay in the domestic market.
But proving that has to be an administrative nightmare.
Oh, it's brutal.
You'd have to track the exact serial number of the imported strut, tie it to the exact tariff paid, prove the exact date and flight number of its re-exportation, and submit all of that flawlessly to Customs and Border Protection.
Yeah, it requires an army of compliance officers. Mm-hmm. And if you get it wrong, or if you simply lack the administrative bandwidth to file for the refund, your facility just absorbs a 20 or 30% arbitrary cost increase.
You end up servicing that landing gear at a massive financial loss.
Exactly. And this is why the executives are locked in a room with the U.S. Trade Representative. They are fighting for survival. They are trying to figure out how to keep their supply lines open and their margins viable amidst global trade wars.
Wow. And while they are battling the macroeconomic forces of international trade on one front, they are facing a completely different structural crisis on the other.
Right, the workforce issue.
Yes. The article mentions an economic briefing from Oliver Wyman Vector focusing on, quote, both business and workforce issues. That dual focus paints a really vivid picture of executive anxieties.
It really does. On one side of the ledger, you have volatile material costs and supply chain chaos. On the other side, you have an existential human capital crisis.
Because you can solve the tariff puzzle, you can get the parts into your facility, but if you do not have highly trained, certified human hands to actually install those parts, the entire system still grinds to a halt.
The workforce issue is the ultimate governor on the engine of this industry. You cannot automate the nuanced, highly specific work of aviation maintenance.
You need a real person.
You need certified, rigorously trained technicians. And the industry is facing a severe demographic cliff and a massive shortage of incoming talent.
Which explains the huge shift in how this association operates politically.
Oh, absolutely.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The text notes that day two, the legislative aspect of this gathering, was, quote, once reserved for a golf tournament.
Which is pretty standard for trade associations.
Right. Trade associations love golf tournaments. They are fantastic for passive networking. But it has evolved into this highly mobilized effort where dozens of maintenance professionals basically storm Capitol Hill to put a personal face on their industry story before Congress.
Yeah. It's a huge culture shift.
You don't abandon the back nine for the grueling halls of congressional office buildings unless you are facing an absolute imperative. It's like a fraternity spontaneously transforming into a high-stakes debate team.
Well, the complexity of modern aviation has just outpaced the utility of a golf tournament.
Yeah.
Passive networking cannot solve a structural labor crisis. Mm. So the agenda they take to Congress is very specific. They are lobbying to fully invest in career development programs, and they are addressing resonating problems from the legislators' prior reauthorizations of the FAA.
Okay, let's drill down into that phrase. Resonating problems from the legislators' prior reauthorizations of the FAA. Now, anyone following this industry knows that an FAA reauthorization bill is this massive legislative vehicle that dictates the funding and regulatory mandate of the agency for years at a time.
Right.
But what specifically goes wrong in those bills that causes, you know, resonating problems for a repair station? When Congress gets an FAA reauthorization wrong, what does a botched rollout actually look like on the hangar floor?
Well, it usually manifests as a well-intentioned political mandate that just lacks functional ground-level mechanics.
Give me an example.
Okay, for instance, Congress might mandate a sweeping new safety standard for composite material inspections in a reauthorization bill.
Which sounds fantastic in a press release.
Right, everyone applauds. But then they fail to provide the FAA with the corresponding funding to actually hire the inspectors required to certify those new procedures at the repair stations.
Oh, wow. So the repair station does the work. They develop the new inspection protocol, but they can't implement it because there is like a 3-year backlog to get an FAA inspector out to their facility to sign off on the paperwork.
Exactly. That's exactly the kind of bottleneck that occurs.
Huh.
Or, you know, Congress mandates a new certification requirement for technicians, but doesn't allocate grants for the technical schools to actually develop the curriculum.
So it's an unfunded mandate.
Precisely.
Yeah.
These are the resonating problems. The legislation creates a mandate without providing the mechanical infrastructure to achieve it. And the result is just administrative paralysis.
And the message ARSA is delivering to Capitol Hill is that this paralysis has real-world consequences. They are representing 300,000 maintenance technicians who need consistent resources and reliable oversight to support the world fleet.
And 300,000 is a huge number.
It is. And, you know, when you hear a number like 300,000, it's easy to let it wash over you as a sterile statistic.
Yeah.
But think about what those 300,000 individuals actually do. They are the people who ensure the commercial plane you board with your family does not experience a catastrophic mechanical failure over the Atlantic Ocean.
Their career development is your safety.
Exactly. When RLS lobbies Congress for career development programs and the elimination of regulatory bottlenecks, they aren't just negotiating for better break rooms or like incremental profit margins. Their career development is the literal safety net for human flight.
Yeah.
If the industry cannot train, retain, and support those 300,000 technicians, that safety net begins to fray.
They are putting a human face on regulatory abstraction. They are explaining to members of Congress that if you write a law that inadvertently chokes off the pipeline of new mechanics or traps existing mechanics in administrative purgatory, the broader aerospace infrastructure degrades.
Right.
They are demanding that legislators understand the secondary and tertiary impacts of their reauthorization bills.
So they fight the domestic political battle in Washington on day two. But as we established with the supply chain discussion, aviation is inherently global.
Very much so.
You can get Congress to write a perfect FAA reauthorization bill, and you still only solve half your problem. Because the moment you step out of the domestic arena, you run headfirst into a massive, overlapping web of international regulators.
Day three, the global alphabet soup.
Yes, day three, March 19th, the annual repair symposium. The article details this segment, which features civil aviation authorities from three continents. You have the FAA representing the United States. You have the UK Civil Aviation Authority. You have ANSC representing Brazil. And you have EAS, the European Union Aviation Safety Agency.
Right. It is an alphabet soup of global sovereign power gathered in a single room.
And this is where the daily operational friction of international maintenance becomes incredibly thorny.
Well, because aircraft are transient assets. A single commercial jet might be registered in Brazil, operated by a carrier in the UK, and then sent to a specialized facility in the United States for an engine overhaul.
And that single repair action instantly falls under the jurisdictional crosshairs of multiple regulatory bodies simultaneously.
Exactly. Everyone wants oversight.
The article points out two major friction points discussed during this symposium. One is safety management systems integration, which we will get to in a moment. But the other one is highly controversial.
Yeah, the drug and alcohol testing.
Right. The author writes that there was considerable attention given to, quote, the expansion of unnecessary drug and alcohol testing program requirements globally.
It's a very specific phrase.
I really have to pause here because unnecessary is a very loaded, highly opinionated descriptor for an author to use in an industry recap.
It definitely stands out.
Why would the aviation maintenance industry fight against global drug and alcohol testing? I mean, that sounds like a public relations nightmare. You don't want the flying public to think mechanics are advocating for the right to turn wrenches while impaired.
No, of course not. Yeah. It is a critical friction point. Mm-hmm. And to understand it, we have to meticulously separate the shared goal of safety from the administrative reality of jurisdiction.
Okay, lay it out for me.
Neither side is arguing that impaired mechanics should be working on aircraft. The conflict is entirely about redundant bureaucracy and sovereign overreach.
So, impartially, what are both sides saying here?
Let's look at the perspective of the global regulatory agencies like ESA or ANS first. Their overriding mandate is public safety, and they operate from a posture of zero tolerance for risk.
Sure, that makes sense.
Their imperative is to implement wide net universally applicable mandates. If they are certifying a repair station to work on European or Brazilian aircraft, they want to mandate their specific drug and alcohol testing protocols globally to ensure absolute compliance with their domestic standards.
Which totally makes sense from a purely liability-driven public safety standpoint. If you were the head of EASA, you want to testify to the European Parliament that every single person touching a European jet, regardless of where they are on the planet, is subject to your testing protocols.
Right. But now look at it from the perspective of a U.S. repair station. This is the perspective represented by the author's use of the word unnecessary. An American technician working at a certified facility is already subject to incredibly rigorous, federally mandated drug and alcohol testing under U.S. law and FAA regulations.
Oh, I see.
If EASA now demands that the repair station also implement a completely separate, slightly different European drug testing protocol for that exact same mechanic, just so they can certify a part for export to the EU, it does not increase safety.
Because the mechanic is already tested.
Exactly. All it does is impose a redundant, expensive, legally complex secondary framework onto a business that is already highly regulated.
It creates a jurisdictional nightmare. You have a U.S. citizen in a U.S. facility trying to navigate European medical privacy laws and Brazilian testing cadences just to satisfy the paperwork requirements of foreign agencies when their own government has already certified them as clean and unimpaired.
It's administrative bloat disguised as safety enforcement. And it perfectly illustrates the central battle cry of this entire conference, the crushing reality of the current data burden.
Right, the data burden. The article notes that significant time was dedicated to discussing rulemaking priorities like the elimination of this data burden and the push for reciprocal acceptance.
Yeah.
Because redundant international data burdens act like a governor on an engine, right?
Yeah.
The industry has the horsepower and the capital to move faster, but the administrative drag physically caps their top speed.
That's a great analogy.
So walk me through the mechanics of a data burden. What does this actually look like for the mechanic? I mean, what is the actual difference between tracking data for safety and tracking data for bureaucratic compliance?
It all comes down to the forms. Let's say a highly skilled technician overhauls a specialized avionics unit.
Okay.
To legally prove the work was done to standard and release the part back into service in the United States, they must complete FAA form 8130-3.
Got it.
This form logs the data, tracks the serial numbers, references the specific maintenance manuals used, and provides the authorized release certificate.
Okay, so that's the baseline safety tracking. You need to know who fixed it, when, and how. That makes sense.
But if that avionics unit might be installed on an aircraft operating in Europe, the facility also has to generate an ESA Form 1.
Okay, another form.
Now, the actual physical work on the avionics unit does not change. The torque settings, the diagnostic tests, the physical safety of the component is completely identical. But the ETAF form requires slightly different terminology, different referencing structures, and compliance with the Maintenance Annex Guidance, or MAG.
So the mechanic, or the quality assurance inspector, has to sit at a computer and painstakingly re-enter identical safety data into a completely different bureaucratic format just to satisfy the sovereign requirements of a foreign agency.
Yes. And multiply that by ANOF requirements for Brazil or UKCAA requirements or Transport Canada requirements.
Oh, my God.
You have highly trained aerospace professionals acting as glorified data entry clerks, navigating incredibly nuanced differences in international administrative law. The data burden is the accumulation of millions of hours of redundant administrative labor across the global supply chain.
Which is exactly why they are so desperate for reciprocal acceptance.
Reciprocal acceptance is the holy grail for them. It is the concept that if the FAA signs off on a repair facility and a component using their rigorous standards, EASA simply accepts the FAA's approval without requiring a secondary layer of redundant European paperwork.
It's basically saying, hey, we both have world-class safety standards. If you say it's good, we trust you.
Exactly.
But achieving that level of trust requires navigating intense geopolitical hurdles and entrenched bureaucratic inertia, because agencies do not like relinquishing their direct oversight, even to allied nations.
They really don't. It's about control.
So you have these incredibly tense, high-stakes negotiations happening. You have executives going toe-to-toe with global regulators over sovereign drug testing mandates, bugging for reciprocal acceptance, trying to dig themselves out from under mountains of redundant paperwork.
It's exhausting.
It sounds exhausting. And you would think after battling trade reps, lobbying Congress, and debating international civil aviation authorities, the conference would just wind down into a cocktail hour.
Right. You'd think they'd be done.
But the final day, day four, features a structural shift that might be the most fascinating part of the entire article.
Yeah, March 20th, the member meeting and breakouts.
The text notes that President Riggs hands the reins of the meeting back to the ARSSA team for a recap and breakout sessions. These sessions cover the major issues, safety management systems, and drug and alcohol issues in a practical and direct manner.
Yep.
But there is a detail hidden in this section that absolutely stopped me in my tracks.
Oh, the role reversal.
Yes. The article states that these breakout sessions provided instruction to the participants, but they also provided learning by the ARSA team, with agency personnel sitting in on the drug and alcohol session to gather information for continuing guidance development.
It is stunning.
Wait, let me get this straight. The Federal Aviation Administration and other agency personnel are sitting in the audience of an industry-run breakout session to ask the mechanics how to write the rules.
It is a complete role reversal. What's fascinating here is that typically the regulatory power dynamic is rigidly top-down.
Yeah.
The agency sits in Washington, they draft the rule based on their interpretation of the legislation, and they issue a mandate, comply or face enforcement actions.
That's how government usually works.
But the presence of agency personnel gathering information from the industry to develop their own continuing guidance implies something profound about the nature of modern aviation. The systems being regulated have become so complex that the regulators themselves do not fully understand the operational ground truth of their own mandates.
That is wild. Let's use safety management systems, or SMS, as the example here, because the article notes this was a major topic in the breakouts. And SMS isn't just a poster in the break room that says safety first, right? It is a highly complex mechanism.
Oh, absolutely. And SMS is a formal, top-down, organization-wide approach to managing safety risk. It's a predictive data architecture.
Predictive.
Yes. Historically, aviation safety was reactive. A plane crashed, investigators found the broken part, and the FAA mandated a fix so that specific part wouldn't break again.
Okay, that makes sense.
But an SMS shifts the industry to a predictive model. It requires a repair station to implement data collection systems that track every near miss, every tool left on a workbench, every slight deviation in a maintenance procedure.
Wow.
The system then algorithmically analyzes that massive data pool to flag systemic risks and probabilities of failure before an accident ever occurs.
It sounds incredibly powerful, but why would the FAA need the industry's help to write the guidance on how to do it? If the FAA wants predictive data, why don't they just tell the repair stations exactly what software to use and what data points to track?
Because a mandate that looks elegant on a whiteboard at FAA headquarters is often impossible to execute uniformly across the entire industry.
What do you mean?
Well, the aviation maintenance sector is not a monolith. You have massive MRO facilities with thousands of employees and dedicated data science teams. But you also have highly specialized five-person repair shops that only overhaul a specific type of vintage landing gear. If the FAA writes a rigid, one-size-fits-all SMS rule, they will inadvertently bankrupt the small shops with software compliance costs while simultaneously handcuffing the massive facilities from innovating their own better system.
Oh, so the regulators sit in on these ARSA breakout sessions to learn how a five-person shop actually operates. They need the people turning the wrenches to explain the mechanical reality of implementing a predictive data architecture in a hangar that smells like hydraulic fluid.
Exactly. They need the industry to help author the practical guidance so that the regulations actually increase safety rather than just increasing the data burden. And this brings us all the way back to the genius of the organizational structure we discussed at the very beginning.
You mean Brett Levanto and the law firm?
Yes. Obadahl, Filler, McLeod, and Klein. If ARSA was just a traditional lobbying group that issued press releases complaining about government overreach, the regulators would just tune them out. But because they utilize an operational team deeply embedded in administrative law, because they integrate daily legal policy with strategic communication, they don't just complain. They create a highly technical, legally rigorous forum where the regulators and the regulated can sit in the same room and hash out the mechanics of compliance.
So they become indispensable.
Exactly. NRSA has made itself so indispensable to the functional reality of aviation safety that the agencies rely on them as partners in regulation.
It is a masterclass in how to wield influence. You don't just fight the system, you become the architectural consultant for the system.
Exactly.
And we have to look at the macro context here to truly understand why all of this matters so much. At the end of the article, there's a section of related articles, which are essentially headlines printed alongside the main text. And the numbers in these headlines are staggering.
They really put it in perspective.
Let's listen to these. GE Aerospace to invest another $1 billion in U.S. manufacturing. Lufthansa Technik lays the foundation for future investments worth billions. ATQ Aviation bolsters global testing portfolio with acquisition of TRX Avionics Solution. And Depot Innovation drives readiness, saves Air Force millions at Oklahoma City Air Logistics Complex.
Those headlines lock the entire narrative into focus. Because when the executives are locked in the E2E briefings fighting with trade representatives over tariff exclusions, and when the membership is marching on Capitol Hill demanding workforce development, they are guarding the infrastructure required to execute those exact investments.
Right. You cannot build a billion-dollar GE manufacturing facility if you cannot source the raw materials due to an unnavigable trade war.
No.
You cannot execute Lufthansa's multi-billion-dollar global vision if your repair stations are paralyzed by overlapping international data burdens and reciprocal acceptance failures.
And you cannot achieve the depot innovation that saves the Air Force millions of dollars without the continuous pipeline of 300,000 highly trained technicians that ARSA was desperately lobbying Congress to support.
Right, because innovation at that scale does not happen in a vacuum.
It requires a baseline of stable regulations, reliable supply chains, and exceptional human capital.
The stakes are astronomical. We are talking about the velocity of global commerce, the readiness of the military, and the fundamental safety of the flying public, all resting on the shoulders of the maintenance sector.
It really is all resting on them.
But amidst all the geopolitical trade wars, the legislative battles, and the billions of dollars in capital investment, the related articles also include a really profound human element.
Yeah, the legends.
Right. There are two other headlines highlighted. Gulfstream President Mark Burns being inducted into the Living Legends of Aviation, and the reporting of the passing of a business aviation icon, Russ Meyer, at the age of 93.
It grounds the entire discussion. It is a reminder that underneath the massive bureaucratic machinery and the corporate acquisitions, aviation is a lineage.
Yeah.
It is an industry built by pioneers who pushed the physical boundaries of flight, and it remains a community that deeply reveres its history.
It reminds us that these aren't just faceless corporations arguing over paperwork. It's a group of people dedicated to the ongoing miracle of keeping heavy metal suspended in the sky.
Beautifully said.
So, what does this all mean? We started this deep dive looking at a trade association conference, and we uncovered the invisible engine of global aviation. We saw how an operational structure managed by Brett Levanto and his specialized law firm translates complex regulatory shifts into daily actionable intelligence, rendering a traditional keynote speech totally perfunctory.
We saw executives battling macroeconomic sources, fighting for tariff refunds to keep the global supply chain intact.
And we watched an industry mobilize on Capitol Hill, fighting to protect the career development of the 300,000 technicians who actually do the work.
We navigated the intense friction between international regulators, highlighting the critical difference between baseline safety tracking and redundant bureaucratic data burdens.
And finally, we witnessed that incredible role reversal where government agencies rely on the industry to help author the functional mechanics of complex regulations like safety management systems.
It is a relentless, high-stakes dance of economics, politics, and raw mechanical skill.
It really is.
And, you know, as we conclude, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder, something that kind of bubbles under the surface of all of this.
Lay it on us.
We looked at those massive financial headlines, GE Aerospace and Lufthansa, pouring billions of dollars into future investments, pushing the boundaries of manufacturing, automation, and aerospace technology.
Right, the billions.
The industry is flooding the zone with capital to build the future of flight. Yet, as this conference reveals, the entire viability of that futuristic system hinges on something incredibly mundane.
The paper.
Exactly. It hinges on eliminating data burdens. It hinges on achieving reciprocal acceptance between nations. It hinges on standardizing the rules for the individual mechanic holding a wrench. The ultimate bottleneck to human flight right now isn't a lack of capital, and it isn't a lack of technological innovation.
Wow.
The bottleneck is the compounding bureaucratic weight of global compliance.
So, will the international bureaucracy be able to evolve fast enough to keep up with the billions being poured into innovation? Or will the future of flight be grounded not by gravity, but by paperwork?
It is a massive question, and it is being fought over every single day in rooms exactly like the ones we discussed today.
It's the ultimate battle for the sky.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you step onto a commercial jet as you walk down that jet bridge, take a moment to look out the window at the tarmac. Look at the maintenance crews out there in the elements. Think about the invisible machinery of rules, the global battles over supply chains, and the 300,000 professionals fighting every single day to ensure that the leap of faith you are about to take is a safe one.